Thomas Talking Metal Podcast, episode 79.
Greetings and welcome to the Thomas Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas, and I hope you've been having a fantastic week. So over the past few episodes, I keep mentioning how busy things are, and while it certainly has not changed, I have been making a fairly strong effort, I would say, to check out more things and stuff to recommend. Unfortunately, last episode, I was not feeling well, and due to that, I was unable to recommend anything except for a couple of brief mentions, but that has changed this week. While somehow I still feel like I'm holding on to some sort of cold or whatever, I have plenty to recommend. On top of that, we have a long interview with Sally Cantorino today, and yeah, it's going to be a long one today, folks, but I think it's chock full of good stuff, so I think you're all going to enjoy it. So, enough yapping about all that. Let's get into the good stuff. All right, first up is comic book recommendations. This week I have a ton. And to start that off, I have a double shot from the team of writer and artist Ibrahim Mustafa, color artist Brad Simpson, letterer Hassan Atsman Elhau, editor Rob Levin, and the company Humanoids. I have the graphic novels Count and the newly released Retroactive. Now, starting off with Count. Count is a sci-fi reimagining of the Count of Monte Cristo, and while I'm not overly familiar with the original book, the only memories I really have of it are, I know there's like a, I think a Leonardo DiCaprio movie of it, I think, maybe? No, not DiCaprio, Jim Caviezel. And I remember reading one of those like Illustrated Classics version of it when I was real young. One was, you know, that's probably like much more condensed version of the story, and like every other page they had like a drawing attached to it. But yeah, so I wasn't super familiar. I knew the general premise, you know, someone gets wrongly imprisoned. They, come into through meeting someone there. They come into some wealth and they come back as someone that people don't know, and you know, kind of gets his revenge and all that. So. That said, you know, I don't think you need to have deep familiarity with the source material. Ibrahim does a fantastic job of updating and making it something seem something new and fresh. It's a very, I kind of found it to be kind of a quick read. And that's not a bad thing at all. It's very, very, very fast paced. And that's probably one too many varies, but it was snappy. It was going. And I've been a fan of Ibrahim's for quite a bit. I remember first coming across his work with High Crimes back in, oh boy, I don't know, some early 2010s era of existence. But his work has just continued to grow and improve, and it was really awesome to see him get a deal with Humanoids to do some graphic novels and all that. And yes, he's been killing it. His art has definitely... I think he's always been good, but it's definitely matured, and he's definitely found his way, and that is especially made clear with the teaming up with Brad Simpson. These gentlemen make a fantastic art team. The style is, you know, grounded in reality, but it doesn't feel like it's, you know, heavily photo referenced or anything like that. You know, characters have plenty of fluidity and things like that, and yeah, I really, really enjoyed the art and the writing on this book. You know, Ibrahim is a fantastic writer as well. And rounding out the book with excellent work is the letters from Hassan. I struggle to say, you know, lots of things about the letters unless they're like extremely prominent or I don't know. Well, prominent's the wrong word because they're on every page, right? For the most part, it's just, you know, they're done well. And everything fits. I liked the choice of not having the traditional tails for the balloons. And everything fit well. Yeah, this is a real fun sci-fi revenge story. You know, it looks beautiful. Reads awesomely. And it's, you know, available everywhere. It's up on Comixology as part of the Unlimited program. And yeah, even if I didn't subscribe to that, it's well worth the price. So the second book from this team is the newly released Retroactive. Now, this is a wholly original story. It is not an adaptation or anything like that. And I will first off say I think I enjoyed this one a lot more than I enjoyed Count. And that's not a knock on Count. Again, I really enjoyed that story as well. But this one felt, you know, there was that movie, was it Jumper, that came out a while ago that was with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis. And this isn't the same type of story, but it tells of, like, you know, Looper, of time loops and things like that. And this felt like the good version of that. Not to knock on that movie too much, but yeah, Retroactive tells the story of Tariq, who is an agent for the Bureau of Temporal Affairs, and they go back and they prevent muckery with the time stream now that there is time travel and all that. And from there, the story gets kind of crazy. There's a lot of time loops. There's a lot of time skipping and things like that. Ibrahim put a lot of work, it looks like, into creating just a lot of rereadability with this book, to kind of go back and see things you may have missed that are referenced again later. And I don't want to give away too much about the plot, because I think, one, it's brand new, it's out, and you should definitely go buy it. And I don't want to spoil any of the twists that are happening in the book. But Ibrahim puts Tariq through the ringer. there's a lot of jumping around with the times, and it can be a little, I don't want to say jarring sometimes, but it makes you stop and kind of like really dig into the book. And I haven't had that in a while with a comic, where I had to give it every bit of attention I had and go back and double check things and kind of see, like, wait, what was this? What happened here? Yeah. Again, I don't want to give away too much, because it's got a lot of great twists, but Ibrahim puts Tariq through the ringer. During an investigation, things start to unravel with everything, and from there it just keeps ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. So yeah, I highly recommend this book. Again, Ibrahim's art is just leveled up once again. And I don't know for sure, but I feel like with this book, he definitely pulled back a lot more from the actual, like, having script, letting a lot of the imagery tell a lot of the story. And I thought that was fantastic. There's a few pages on here, especially one where he's kind of literally illustrating a time loop that was real fun to read. That you kind of like have to like turn the book to kind of follow and all that, which was kind of funny, because I was reading it on my iPad, so I didn't have the portrait lock on, so it kept turning, so I was getting a little cursing it a little bit there, but that's just technology. It's not Ibrahim's fault there. But yeah, you know, I don't want to say too much about this book. I think it's best to go into kind of fresh, but if you like kind of time travel-y action adventure stories, this is definitely a great one to go and check out. So yeah, that's Retroactive. It's out from Humanoids. It's out in Comixology. It's out at all finer bookstores and comic shops. And yeah, definitely go check that out. All right, my next comic book recommendation is the first issue of Ninja Kaidan from Black Box Comics. Now, I had a great opportunity to read an early PDF of this book, and it is really, really, really fun. It is written by Eric Palicki, art by Lucas Meyer, colors by Michael Bartolo, lettering by Desi Cienti. Now, Ninja Kaidan is about a soldier named Yuki, who is forced to kind of take over as CEO of his father's company after he passes, and is in charge of this program where you wear this armor and you can see, speak to, and touch ghosts. And that's a really cool premise to begin with, but throw in, you know, the fact that it's, you know, a martial arts story, and it might as well be called Ninja Ghost Fighter. And you have my interest. It is really, really fun. This is the first issue, so while there's a lot of world building and kind of exposition-y stuff that needs to kind of happen, Eric does a fantastic job of just weaving that in, you know, super smoothly throughout everything. And I think he was given a pretty big task trying to explain the armor and the building and the situation and what they're trying to do and all that, and still keep everything, you know, action-packed and snappy and kind of going like that. So, yeah, Eric did a fantastic job. He's a super talented writer. And the art by Lucas Meyer is super slick. This is this gentleman's pretty dang talented, I would say. He would he'd definitely be courted by the big two in no time, for sure. But this story is really, really fun. The armor looks awesome. And, yeah, you're fighting ghosts in a ninja suit. Naturally, there is much more laid out in terms of the story. There's obviously some twists coming along, especially with the last page. So, yeah, it was definitely a fun read. It read very, very fast, I will say that. It kind of felt like it was over before I got a chance to kind of settle in. And that's not a critique in the negative at all. It left me wanting more. So I'm definitely looking forward to checking out the rest of this book. But yeah, Ninja Kaidan, it is going to be out in July. I'll make sure there is a pre-order code in the show notes. But yeah, if you're looking for something that's, you know, got a 90s comic, you know, fast-paced feel in a good way, with great writing and fantastic art, definitely check it out. Ninja Kaidan. I mean, come on. Ninja Ghost Fighter. What more do I say? Do you even like comics if you don't like this? Come on. All right, next up is my music recommendations. I have a couple this week, so let's get right to it. First up is the new EP, Portals, from Kirk Hammett. Yes, you heard me correct. Kirk Hammett. Metallica actually let a member do a side project. You know, granted, it took the band like almost over 40 years to kind of be cool with something like that. But yeah, it's finally here. So personally, I'm a fan of Kirk Hammett. I know there's a lot of, I guess, discourse about his use of the wah pedal and all that. But it's a joke that he is definitely in on. He even had a wah off with somebody with a giant wah pedal. The guy gets it, you know. But yeah, I like Kirk, especially since the 2000s, where you kind of got to meet more of his personality in the band and kind of the realization he's a big dork like the rest of us. And that's awesome. You know, he loves his horror comics and his horror stuff. And yeah, he seems like the one member I actually do want to meet of Metallica. So I was pretty stoked when I saw that he was going to have his own EP come out and kind of get a chance to branch out and stuff. Because I know, based on interviews and things like that, he has a lot of different influences. He's been taking in a lot of different styles to play. And when he's had a few guest spots here and there on other albums, most notably a Santana album, it was cool to see, you know. Because I'm so familiar with his playing in Metallica, it's nice to see someone branch out and kind of do some different things. So, and that's what this is. The Portals EP can best be described as kind of a instrumental, cinematic kind of vibe. It's definitely, there's no overarching kind of musical narrative happening. It's not intended to be like a soundtrack to a specific thing. They did kind of start off as background music for a traveling show he had of his collections and stuff like that, but it is definitely something that's just kind of very vibe heavy. You know, of the songs, Maiden and the Monster, The Djinn, High Plains Drifter, The Incantation, they all kind of have their own mood, their own kind of feel, and definitely pull in their different influences. And you know, while you can easily say like, oh, it kind of sounds like a Metallica type thing, yeah, because the guy's part of fucking Metallica. You know, he writes what he writes, right? But there's definitely other influences coming in that kind of switch it up. And it's interesting to hear his music and his stuff, you know, the stuff that kind of like would be on a Metallica album, but through the filter of not being, I guess not through the filter, being unfiltered by Lars and James's influences and kind of seeing there, because it goes in different directions, you know, different changes happen with the chords and all that, that I would think if it were to be a Metallica song, they would either change up a bit, simplify, or make more into their overall sound. Now, the cinematic description for the EP is, I think, very apt. Listening to it, it was very easy to just kind of get into that voob vibe / mood. The new term, voob. The voob was great. I love voob. This is what happens when you record a podcast at 6 a.m. Anyway, it's really fun. It's easy to kind of get lost into the music. That's especially helped with the contributions from Edwin Outwater, who was the conductor from the most recent SNM2 effort that Metallica teamed up with the San Francisco Symphony with. And yeah, it creates a very, they have the Morricone vibe, because Metallica loves the spaghetti Western stuff and all that. But it feels different. Like any comparisons to Metallica on this EP, it's solely just because, as a musician, you kind of have your language and, you can't just erase that language willy nilly, but I wouldn't listen to any of this and say that should be a Metallica song. I listen to it and I say, this sounds, like something Metallica could do, and something like that. And it's certainly not a knock. It's not a criticism. Again, especially since, the guy's been in the band for 40 years. His influences are going to be over everything. If he doesn't have as extensive a writing credit as the other two guys, he's all over everything. So one thing I was really surprised with, and not to extend the joke, was Kirk's use or lack of use of the wah pedal in the solos. And I tried to read a few interviews. I haven't seen anyone really mention that. I don't know if this was just him further trying to differentiate from his Metallica sound, or if it was just I'm on my own, let me kind of strip away what, people kind of have called a crutch, which, if you ever used a wah pedal and playing guitar and all that, you could kind of use it as a little bit of a crutch, but I think the way Kirk uses it is to get the right vibe and voob, to get the voob of it all. So yeah, I'm meandering a bit around describing this album, but it's a really fun experience. It's cinematic, it's epic, it's really fun instrumental. If you're a writer and you like writing to instrumental things, definitely check this out. It's hard to pick a favorite on this, because some of them are pretty long, and it's just kind of even though they have their own influences, they kind of just drift in and out of each other. But I think the first single, High Plains Drifter, that's what really hooked me, and I think that has the most easy appeal to kind of walk right into and get comfortable with what this EP is going to bring you. So let's hear a snippet of that. High Plains Drifter, Portals EP, Kirk Hammett, Out Everywhere.
You caught me in the middle of drinking coffee while reading comics and listening to metal. Do you ever get curious about how your favorite creators get their inspiration? Have you ever wondered what led them down this path? Well, join me, noted comic book heartthrob Grant Stoy, as I do deep dive interviews with some of the best comic book folks around on Into the Comics Cave. Each week we examine a creator's history and find out stuff like where they grew up or whether or not birds with lips are sexy. You can find us on Apple, Stitchers, most anywhere you stream your podcasts. Now back to my favorite hugger in the world, Don Cardenas.
All right, my second music recommendation this week is the new album Immutable from Meshuggah. Meshuggah is a band I am long overdue in doing a deep dive on. I tried a while ago, back when, you know, I heard that their first couple albums were kind of thrashy, you know, thrash metal type stuff, and they're not 100% my cup of tea, but I definitely enjoy them when I hear them. It's just one of those things where it's like, I've just never sat down and really listened to any of their albums. So when this new one came out, I'm like, let me take a chance and sit down with this and all that. And it's 1 hour and 7 minutes of just getting your ass kicked. Orally. Orally? I don't know. In your ear holes. You're just getting pummeled. That doesn't sound any better, Don. Anyway. So tracks like, you know, The Abysmal Eye, Broken Cog, God He Sees in Mirrors are just... those are kind of the standouts to me. But it's 13 tracks. It's just a ton of just heavy, heavy aggressiveness. And I don't, you know, while a lot of them can be, a lot of talk about Meshuggah is like how technical they are and all that, it doesn't feel, some stuff is definitely technical, but it doesn't feel like that's a barrier of entry. Because sometimes there's this tech metal stuff that's just kind of like, it's so technical. It's just like, all right, I get it. But, you know, for Meshuggah, brutality comes first. And that's the driving force. Anything that technical comes with it is just, you know, you're already along for the pummeling. So it kind of glosses over you and it just becomes part of the experience. So, yeah, if you're new to Meshuggah, I think you're going to dig it. If you're an old school fan, sounds like everyone else really digs it. So definitely check it out. Big riffs, big kick drums. just 1 hour, 7 minutes of just pure savagery, and I dig it. So, to pick a favorite track, oh, that's tough. There's a lot of great tracks on here. Much like the Kirk Hammett EP I just talked about, it all kind of flows in together, though. It kind of just like, kind of washes over you, and it's very much an experience. So, I don't know. I'm staring at the track list right now, and I'm like, what do I pick? What do I tell people? Like, you want to listen to this album? Here's what you go. Here's what you check out. You know what? I'm not going to sway from the band's own decision. They chose The Abysmal Eye as their lead single, and that's what hooked me. So that's got to be what hooks you, right? So let's check it out. Meshuggah, The Abysmal Eye, album Immutable. It's been out everywhere. Go check it out.
Matter sing creation.
All right, it is now time for my guest. If I had to describe my guest's art style, it would be fluid yet gritty, open yet detailed, and it is something that straddles the line between all those things that kind of drives me insane when I see, because I don't understand how someone can achieve all those things at one time. And above that, her style her art has graced everything from comics, illustration, role-playing games. But before I ask her about her process, the tools she uses, her soon-to-be-wrapped Vault series Human Remains, her work on the latest RPG Children of Uma, and of course, her guitars, I have to ask, Sally Cantorino, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the most important tool in my toolbox to make the art that I do is rolling out of bed and having my coffee.
Nice.
Very important part of the process. There is a 2-pound bag of the Danhausen coffee from Rootless.
Okay.
Ready to be drank.
This is a Rootless show, for sure.
Excellent.
For sure.
Yeah, my comics are basically like powered by 5-pound bags of Rootless coffee.
Yeah, same. I just switched back to the Damn Fine blend. We were doing the,
nice.
I forget the name of it, but it's the one that Brian Level did the art for, the Big Lebowski inspired one.
Oh, yeah. I'm blanking on the name too, but I know.
Yeah, that one was really good. But after a while, my wife and I were just like, let's go back to Damn Fine, just because it's damn fine. It's such a perfect coffee to drink all day that, it's hard not to. So I haven't tried the Danhausen one yet, though.
It's really good. Our usual pick is the dark coffee from Rootless. But they had a spring sale, so we got a couple pounds of the Danhausen coffee because I bought it for my partner for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And he was like, this is the best coffee I've ever had.
Nice.
Yeah. And we're just putting it through like a shitty like Keurig. We're not like fancy people.
No, I mean,
and he's like, this is the best coffee I've ever had.
Yeah.
So thank you, Danhausen.
There you go. Very good coffee. Was it very nice, very evil?
Very nice, very evil, very caffeinated.
Yes. I think that's the one blend I haven't tried, because I started with the dark because I came aware of Rootless because, you know, I know Kelly Williams who did the art for the dark. And I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of cool. And then it was easily like the best dark roast I've ever had, period.
It's really good. It makes a good iced coffee, cold brew.
Yeah, I'm not big into the iced coffee or the cold brew stuff. I have to give it a fair shot. But usually when I have coffee, even if it's like a piss hot day outside, it's like, I like my coffee hot. I don't know what it is.
I usually start with an iced coffee because usually like I'm rolling out of bed and then like an hour later I'm going to go like work out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I want to get this caffeine into my system as fast as possible so I don't get a headache.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, I get that. I mean, and I can say during the summer, I've definitely had my fair share of iced coffees. Yeah. It's just, you know, making it at home. I never really, I just never figured out how to do it right. Probably what it is.
Oh, we just dump all of the leftover coffee into just like one container and it's just like sludge.
For a long while, I was into doing smoothies after my workouts. And I was just like, one day I just realized like, oh, I got a little bit of coffee left over here. Let me pour some of that.
Just put this in.
Yeah. So, and since I've expanded my coffee vocabulary since doing the show, like, I just like so many awesome blends where I'm like, man, this would be really good in a smoothie. Like the, to bring back Rootless, the Berry Kiss one. That would be a great one to do. So awesome.
I bet the nostalgia one that I did for Rootless would be good in a smoothie.
It's
a pretty like fruity, floral kind of coffee.
Yeah. That kind of blend isn't necessarily my bag when it comes to it, but I know my wife tends to like that kind of stuff a little bit more than I do. But I don't know. I've tried so many different coffees and coffee brands, in the past year or so that like, I feel like I don't even know what I like anymore sometimes because I'll get something out of, you know, somewhere else and someone did a version of something I don't like, but did it a different way. All of a sudden I like that now. So it's like, I don't know. I'm a very confused coffee person at the current moment.
Yeah. My usuals are either, rootless or, local to Central Jersey, Bhusker Du, has a location in the same building where I go work out. So I end up stopping there and getting coffee, and they have a Jersey diner blend, which doesn't taste anything like actual diner coffee, but it is like a really solid light roast.
Nice. Are you strictly black coffee type person or?
No, my go-to is usually like a little bit of the Chobani, either the oat milk or the regular milk, mm-hmm. the sweet creamer, okay. Just splash of that in.
Okay. Yeah. I'm a half and half, a little bit of sugar guy myself. I'm trying to, I occasionally try to go with just black coffee, but I can't do it. My wife can. And I'm like,
I'm
too much of a wuss. Like it's, I can't handle it. She's just like, I could do, you know, one day I think
my mom can do it. I can do it out of desperation sometimes when I have to get like fasting blood work, mm-hmm. and I can't have any kind of dairy or sugar.
Yeah.
But like, I don't need to start my day this way.
No. Yeah. If, especially me, like I usually get up around 5 and I'm like, I need my coffee my way. I can't.
Yeah.
I, you know, maybe if it's like later in the day and I just don't, and I'm out of half and half or something and, or whatever, I'm like, yeah, it's fine. I'll just drink it like this. But you know.
Yeah. I have nothing to prove to anyone.
That's right.
I have nothing to prove to anyone.
I should try that Kobani stuff. Cause you're not the first, you're like maybe the third or fourth person to mention that kind of creamer to me. So I
think I was drinking a different one for a long time. And then that was the creamer that my boyfriend always has at his place. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, this is the creamer I drink now.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. I think I tried oat milk before. Cause someone's like, oh, oat milk's like the best alternative to regular milk. And I'm like, oh, you know, I wouldn't mind cutting out the dairy sugars or whatever. And I'm like, I had oat milk and I was like, no, it just makes everything taste like oat. and I
find that the Chobani brand is good. And there was one that was called like, oat, yeah.
Yeah.
Or something. I forget what brand put it out, but it was my go-to. And then it got weirdly hard to find during the height of the pandemic.
Oh God. Yeah. I've, there's like multiple things in our household right now that it's like, why isn't this around anymore? It's so random.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I think I'll have to try the Kobani, at least the creamers in general, and start switching and seeing, because if I could just do like a sweetened creamer as opposed to adding sugar on top of half and half, that's probably better, I would think, health wise.
I don't know.
I'll have to see and disappoint myself when I actually read the nutritional facts to everything I'm doing.
Oh, I'm sure it's terrible.
All right. Well, I think we got coffee pretty well covered.
I think so.
So, comics and metal, what's ticking your boxes these days with those?
Do we want to do comics?
It is, do we want to talk about comics? It is guest choice. Your prerogative to do whatever you want to talk about.
So let's move to comics. Right. Let's get to the business segment of this.
All right.
And then we'll talk about metal, and I want to hear about your guitars too at the end.
Oh,
I saw you rearrange your office.
Yeah, it's, oh God. I'll do my best to keep it short for everyone who's already listened to the show before. I've already gone off on my guitars before. It's, you know, it's just like when I talk, you know, if I'm talking to someone about my kids, you know, it's like, I just won't shut up about them. But, yeah. Okay. So comics, let's get to it.
Let's get to comics.
All right. What,
where do we start?
Well, what's some comics you've been reading lately that have, been really working for you?
I just caught up on last book you'll ever read by From Vault.
Okay.
Colin Bunn writing. Catching up on We Ride Titans from Vault. And then I have Dirtbag Rapture and Homesick Pilots in my queue to read. I'm in a weird period where I actually have a little time off and I'm still not tackling my to read pile.
You kind of, the thing about again, this has been covered many times in many places, but when you're making the things, decompressing isn't, you know, like reading them doesn't decompress you the same way as it used to anymore.
Yeah.
So it like, you know, playing a video game or playing guitar or whatever, or just doing something different than anything comics related works more. And, you know, it's like right now I'm in the middle of like a super deadline heck hole. And the main thing I'm thinking about is not like, oh, I can't wait to sit down and read some comics.
Yeah, it's like, I can't wait to not look at comics for a month.
Like, I'm...
And just, like, play Castlevania and work on my cross-stitch projects.
Exactly. It's like, oh, man, I gotta play my guitars more. Or, you know, I got some courses on how to, you know, learn a few more tricks with guitars. And my wife and I have been feeling a nostalgia pull to, like, play some, you know, Nintendo. My daughter's recently got into like Mario videos.
Nice.
And all that. So we're just surrounded with like the Super Mario theme and game. So I'm like, you know, we got some emulators on your old laptop. We can just hook that right up to the TV and we can just like have a game night or something. So like, I'm looking forward to doing something like that. And
yeah,
not that I don't, you know, again, it's not that we don't love comics. We love comics so much that it's what we do. It's just after that, it's like, okay, we need something else.
It's like that tweet about that's like going from the bad screen to looking at the good screen.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, exactly. Looking at the bad screen, the work computer, and looking at the good screen, my phone, you know? Or it takes a little bit of time to be like, okay, I'm going to like sit down and actually like catch up on my read list, catch up on everything, actually get into a comic shop. Like, leave the house, but not too much because it's wild out there.
Yeah. It's thankfully around me, like the comic shop I used to go to is 40 miles away from where I live. And it's when I used to work in Chicago proper, I would go there. Shout out Challengers Comics Chicago. But there are a couple comic shops in the area, but they're just like standard comic shops. And, you know, I don't feel a great pull to go there. I'm mainly a digital reader now when I do read stuff. And to be honest, most of the stuff I do read is stuff people send me from either people I know or, you know, people who want to be on the show or something, and they send me what they're working on or whatever. And I'll read it. But, you know, I have a huge backlog of stuff like on Comixology I want to read. And, I recently tried to like, okay, I'm going to carve out some time. I'm going to read some stuff on Comixology. And then I realized that they did that whole weird app thing when Amazon kind of absorbed it. So like, it was kind of a mess. And then,
yeah.
And then, you know,
don't get me started.
And then I was getting super frustrated because your book, Human Remains, like just the first issue was on Comixology. And I wanted to catch up on this. I thought there would be more. And I briefly remembered, I think we may have had a conversation about this separately about how it's just not there. This is, for some reason, is this not a Comixology? I don't know what
stuff is just not there. Like, I had like when they first made the changes. So I worked on a Comixology originals project, The Final Girls, and it's just like all the Comixology original projects are now buried, and all the links to them that would have gone, like if you Google it or embedded links from like reviews and stuff, any kind of press, it just takes you to like the Comixology storefront. Like, everything's broken. It's really frustrating.
Thankfully I had Final Girls like already in my library, but getting to it and linking up the accounts and all that, it was just like, by the time I was done doing all that, I'm like, I don't want to read anything in right now. Like,
I'm exhausted. Yeah. I can't read comics now. Like, I just spent 2 hours trying to get Comixology to
exactly.
work.
Exactly. And, you know, a couple of buddies had like a super big sale on their books. I think Michael Morisi had a sale like on Barbaric, his series. And I'm like, oh, I wanted to check that out. So I'm like spending 15 minutes trying to figure out how to buy it. for like the whatever $2 it was for the trade.
Yeah.
And same thing with the, was it Jonah and the Impossible Monsters from the Somnies? It's like,
yeah,
it's like, why'd you make this so complicated, man? Like, just,
it's like, I started reading digitally because I, you know, I was renting, so I was moving every year because renting is a nightmare, as we all know. So I was moving every year, so I was like, I can't deal with physical books.
Yeah,
especially if I move states, I can't. I can only media mail so many boxes of comics, and I don't want to have to deal with like, what do I do with all these long boxes or shoe boxes full of single issues? So I started buying a Comixology. I was also living in Gainesville, Florida at the time, and it was kind of a trek from where I lived in Gainesville to the side of town where the like good comic shop was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But now I'm back up in New Jersey, and like where I live, the Geekery is very close by, and they're a great little shop in Matawan. And Paradox is right up by where my boyfriend lives.
Okay.
So there's like good comic shops. There's places where I could start a pull list, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm really tempted to go back instead of just like popping in every couple of months and just being like, oh, what was I going to buy? What was I going to get? Is it in a trade yet? Can I just buy the trade now? Did I take that long to finally find time to come into the comic shop and buy things?
To answer your question, yes, that's how.
Yeah,
you were,
is it in a trade yet?
Is it in a trade now?
I want to support you. Like, I'll buy a trade.
Yeah,
because I have been not in the comic shop for 9 months because I've been drawing comics.
It's really difficult to buy. Like, I have a pretty sizable shelf, IKEA Kallax shelf, full of trades. I have maybe a dozen short boxes in my closet, and half of it's like my collection from when I was younger, and the other half is just stuff I bought from like, I want to say like 08 to like 14, 15.
Yeah.
When was my daughter born? My 16. So from like, you know, for like several years of buying afterwards. And, you know, I wasn't much of a digital reader. Like, the first tablet I had was like a Kindle Fire. And like, the only comic that looked good on there was like Chew, because the art style like was, yeah. It was, you know, it was cartoonish enough to where it's like, I didn't have to see every little detail in there. Like, Rob, like Guillory, like did a great job of like making it very readable on a small screen. And then I got like a 10-inch Samsung tablet. I'm like, okay.
That was my first tablet, was like a 8 or 9 or 10-inch Samsung Galaxy.
Yeah, I got tablet. Mine was the Note 10.1, and I got it because I had a Wacom digitizer with the pen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, I could start drawing on this. And it was okay. You know, the screen was really nice. It had like a lot of drag to it. Really, it was a really great screen. But it was an Android tablet, and that thing was, I bought it in 2014, and it was obsolete by 2016.
Yeah.
And that frustrated me so much. I had to like, what they call it? Jailbreak it or something, just so I could just like upload, yeah, a better version of Android operating system so I could like use current versions of apps.
Yeah.
And then when the, you know, pandemic hit and all that, you know, my wife and I were in a lucky position to where the first stimmies were like, well, you know, what can we do with this? And I'm like, I'm going to invest in an iPad Pro. And
yeah, and that's where it's at.
And reading comics on the 12.9 iPad Pro is a gorgeous experience.
It's great. I had a Galaxy, just like a, you know, I think it was like $200 or $300 like Galaxy tablet. And it lasted me like a good 5 years or so. And then when the iPad Pros came out, like once again, because I was moving house every year, it was just like, I don't have the space in a rental to like have a Cintiq.
Yeah.
Nor do I have the budget for a Cintiq. I didn't know if I wanted to like gamble on getting a Huon or any other, mm-hmm, brand. and the iPad Pros came out, and it was just like, well, I can get a refurbished one and a pencil for like $600-700. And it like changed my life. I was doing everything analog before that. I was penciling everything analog before that. That was like 2017, I think I got my iPad. Because before that, all I had was like a walk-on bamboo.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I still like, have mine. Mine's put away somewhere. I danced around a lot with digital. Like I had a Monoprice screen, 19-inch screen that was like $200. And the thing was trash. But it was good. It was good for like doing touch-ups, or like I did some coloring on there or whatever, or some like quick pencil layout stuff. And then in 2016, I upgraded to a Huion screen, and that was a lot better, but it was still, the pen still felt really cheap, and like I couldn't get the right feel in doing things. But I did a lot of preliminary work and coloring on that, you know, that it worked great for that stuff. And then, yeah, eventually, yeah, the iPad, like that's what made everything click for me when I got the iPad, in terms of like,
yeah, that, yeah. I mean, I do my layouts and my pencils on my iPad. Then I just like print them out onto 11x17 Bristol board. I have a big old like Epson Workforce, print it out onto 11x17 Bristol and ink it analog. I do some illustration stuff in Procreate or Clip Studio, but yeah, like it took just hours out of my workflow being able to just use my layouts as like rough pencils and pencil over them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of times now, like I can just skip like the hardcore penciling stage, you know, and it really streamlined for me. It really streamlined because I do pretty much all my sequentials now on the iPad. I want to do more traditionally, but right now I have to get them done. This is how I can get them done, because I can bring the iPad out with me into the living room with the kids and all that, and I could do it that way. If Daddy brings out a quill and ink, all of a sudden I'm just gonna spend time cleaning up spilled ink from the floor and little fingers. For me, though, it didn't click till like when the iPad, because it felt most like the pencil itself and all that. They felt the most normal. And then when I found the right brush to use in Clip Studio, that kind of gave me the right feel of like how it felt like when I actually did ink, the response and all that. So that was crucial for me. Was that like a learning curve for you on that? Because your brush style to me, it's very distinct. So like trying to recreate that digitally, was that kind of like a huge hurdle? Or
I don't feel like I try to recreate it digitally. Okay. Like when I do sequential work, when I do comics, I am doing all of those inks analog, unless it's like an edit that I have to go in after that's small. Mm-hmm. I do all of the inking analog, just a like $9 Pentel brush pen on the Canson XL Bristol board, like nothing fancy here. White gel pen, like the Pentel Presto whiteout. Like it's very lo-fi.
Well, see, that's
nothing fancy.
That's the
no stable here.
That's the thing.
Not anymore.
That's the thing, though. It's like it's the tools are so inconsequential. It's what you're comfortable with. It's what you're good with, you know. And if
at the beginning of the pandemic, I started drawing Final Girls, and when I went to stock up on supplies for inking, it was right when the pandemic hit, and like borders were shut down, things were out of stock. I could no longer get the like Raphael 8404s that I had been using, like a traditional brush and ink. And I was like, well, what do I have that I've impulse bought from Jet Pens that feels the most like inking with this brush, that has some kind of control to how much like ink flow there is that is like that I can order and actually get in the mail. And it was that. And so that's just been what I've been inking with since. But to answer your question with digital, like, yeah, I found like one or I think like two brushes in Procreate that I think are both from True Grit Texture Supply.
I hear a lot of good things about
that. And
them.
Then Clip Studio, I think, I don't even remember. Like, I mostly just pencil in Clip Studio. I don't usually ink. Okay. So I just kind of use whatever, like, stock pencil, like mechanical pencil, whatever came with the program.
And you mentioned you have the good old Epson Workforce printer that pretty much everyone has. We just had to replace ours. Mine was just about 10 years old, and it finally, like, we were having trouble printing from it, and it was driving my wife nuts because she's like, I just want to print the picture, and like it just was not printing right. Like, no matter what I did, cleaning heads, what, it just was not working well.
Yeah.
And then one day, this past Saturday, I was like, I printed out a thing for my daughter, and I printed out perfectly in color. It looked great. I'm like, oh, wow. And the minute it finished printing, fatal error pops up on the thing. And
it's one last.
Yeah, it's like
one last. It's like
I gave it all I got, boss. We're done. And the hinges.
I did it for you.
The hinges were broken on the scanner. It was like the Wi-Fi module was like kept like disconnecting when we were trying to print. It was time to replace it beforehand. And we actually had ordered the newer version a couple months ago, but it took a couple months to get in. It actually came in on a week ago before it broke. So it's just giant box just sitting in the office waiting. Cause I'm like, I have all this ink for the old one. We got to print and use it because it's not the same ink cartridges. And I don't know what to do with this old ink. And I don't want to just like get rid of it.
Yeah.
But then like the best of, tragic endings of like pets, they made the decision for us and we didn't have to put it out. So. But it was also a point of contention because my wife's like, you're doing everything digital now? Do you really need this giant ass printer anymore? And I'm like, but I plan on going back. I'm a bit particular with the things I do use traditionally, not that it's necessarily fancy. It's just, I know what I like. And I guess when I have the type of paper I like and the pens I like and all that, my brain is just more soothed to doing it. It feels more appropriate. Well, I'm trying to get away from that, but yeah, I'm trying to get back to traditional. I have to do a couple pinups traditionally next month, so I'll have to knock the rust off then. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big believer in like whatever gets the job done. If it's digital, if it's analog, for me, like, I feel like inking analog is better for me because when I ink digitally, I'm either zoomed too far out or too far in. And it's either like, I look at it when it's done and it's just like, I could have done so much better with this, or all of this is going to get lost. Why did I spend all my time on this?
I'm definitely guilty of the too zoomed in. But I think that kind of stems with like before I switched to digital, I was kind of considering switching to just doing larger paper, like maybe doing 18 by 24 pages, just because I'm pretty heavy handed in terms of my inks. And not that I like, oh, I throw a lot of ink down. It's like, no, I press really hard. So my lines are always like stupid thick, and which is fine. If your style kind of fits that, and mine never really did. So it was always this contention of like having to like physically restrain myself from putting down these big fat ink lines. So I was just thinking like, well, if I draw bigger, they'll shrink down smaller.
It's worth a shot.
But I think, using the iPad and all that, it's definitely got me to lighten up a bit too, because I can't press too hard on the iPad screen because I can see it flex sometimes when I'm pressing down.
I think so. I had a 2019 or 2017 iPad that lasted me into 2020, mm-hmm. and it needed a screen replacement halfway through because my cat just yeeted it off the table and shattered the screen. So it had one screen replacement before. It's still chugging. It's just like cannot handle the amount of work I put it through anymore. Like, it's been retired to being a Netflix machine. Nice. And then I upgraded to like a 2020 iPad, and I blew through that. And like by the end of a year, it was starting to like glitch and have like screen issues. And I was just like, am I pressing too hard? Like, what did I do? Like, now I got to trade this in and hope they don't test to see how the screen is.
Am I recalling correctly? Like, yeah, I think you're having a similar issue I was having at one point where like, it was like random lines just flying off.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me.
Yeah. And I got to a point where I was just like, I can't spend days troubleshooting mm-hmm. this. I can't not have an iPad for 2 weeks because I'm on a monthly work schedule. I was just like, I'm just going to see what Apple will give me, or like Best Buy will give me, like store credit mm-hmm. and like hope that they don't test to see how the screen is doing because it's doing bad. Yeah. It just got to a point where it was like, I couldn't draw with it. Oh. It was just like, I can't not have this. I'm on a monthly schedule.
Yeah. Thankfully, whenever that problem hasn't happened too frequently for me. And usually when it does, if I just like, except my iPad's like always on. So it's like, if I just shut it off and restart it, it usually like, it's never not stopped doing that. So
it got to a point where it was just like, nothing was working.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely trying, because right now what this iPad right now is, I think it's about 2 years old now. So I've been using it for 2 years pretty steadily. And I feel like I've needed to start like just like squirreling a little bit of money away for like a new iPad fund just in case.
Yeah.
And then whenever this one like isn't good for drawing anymore, it is definitely earmarked for just being my comic reader. Because, mm-hmm. you know, coming from it sounds kind of hoity-toity, but I was talking to my wife, I'm like, you know, I feel like I need a second iPad just for comics. And she's like, what? And I'm like, no, just something that like, I don't work on this thing. This is just for me reading.
It's like the good screen versus bad screen.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, but the problem is like, even like the basic iPads now, they're compatible with the Pencil. So it's like, yeah. I'm gonna be like, well, I could definitely just work on this if I wanted to. And she's like, you're being stupid. I'm like, I fully acknowledge I am being stupid, but it's just one of those things where it's like, so now my brain's like, you know what, when this one isn't good for working anymore and you get the new one, that when, you know, when the M2 or 3 processor, whatever that one's going to be out, whenever, hopefully it's that long before I have to replace it. But yeah, I feel like I just needed that mental, like you said, good screen, bad screen separation. I considered like trying to rehab my old Samsung tablet to be just like a straight up comic reader, but man, that thing, if it's on for more than 10 minutes, the back feels like a space heater. So I'm just like, and it takes.
You're just like, this is a fire hazard. Like, weren't these the ones that were like exploding on planes?
Yeah, like,
back in the day, in the before times.
Didn't CeeLo get like burns from one of these things? Yeah, and I've replaced the battery on it too. It's just, and it takes forever to charge too. Like, I plug it in overnight and it'll go like 25%. Like, it's ridiculous.
It tried its best. Yeah. I
won't consider myself an Apple fanboy, but I definitely like, I haven't had this problem before with iOS devices.
Yeah.
Anyway,
comics.
So you're finishing up Human Remains, or it's you're finished, but it's coming out, the final issue.
The final issue is coming out May 11th. if previews is not lying to me in a different window.
Or some other reason, paper shortage reason, that it's pushed back another week or so, or whatever god-awful reason it is comics get delayed now these days. Was this the longest project you've ever worked on?
Yes. Yeah, this would have been... This was 8 issues. I Walk with Monsters was 6 issues. Okay. And Final Girls was 5. So yeah, this was the longest series that I had drawn so far.
Do you have like I don't want to say aspirations, but like, do you kind of like doing the miniseries move on kind of scenario, or are you like, I like to have like a nice long run on something. Job security aside, that obvious caveat aside.
Yeah, the format that I worked on at Comixology and that I've been working at in Vault is pretty much exactly what I want to be doing. Like, I don't want to do graphic novels. I don't really want to have a ongoing for years and years and years. Like, this like 6, 8, 10 issue window feels good to me, feels right. It's like enough time that I want to live in that world.
Awesome. Yeah, that's definitely something that when I think about it, it definitely appeals to me. Like, just having an end to something in mind, I think it makes the creation of something a bit more enjoyable, I think. Even though it can be bittersweet if you're enjoying the story you're creating and all that. But just knowing there's an end there, I guess it just feels more satisfying and complete.
Yeah, and then you have all these like mini ends built in. Mm-hmm. When you're working on a monthly schedule, like you're doing issues, which I like too. I like, my brain enjoys having work broken down into like clear sort of like, this is what you just have to like get through these 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then you can breathe and then you do the same thing over again. Like, if it was like, all right, you have a graphic novel, draw for 2 years or draw for 5 years, like, I would lose my mind. I wouldn't know how to like break it down into digestible amounts. But saying like, okay, you're drawing 22 or 24 or 28 pages in 6 weeks, let's do this. It's like, all right, yeah, I can handle that. That date looks like a real date.
Yeah, that's definitely something I'm trying to do, because, you know, I do comics part-time, and at best I have 4 to 5 hours a day to work on comics, and it's not consecutive. It's a couple in the morning, maybe one or two in the afternoon, a couple in the evening. And so me like taking on these larger scale projects are just, it feels insurmountable. And when the pandemic hit and I started doing all these, I kind of like doubled down on doing shorter stuff. You know, I put out a tweet like, hey, because I saw a lot of upcoming comic writers like, you know, I'm finally going to start doing more shorts, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to have a low page rate. Hit me up. And I got hit up. So I'm like, all right, cool. And this like, because even for me, like doing 6 pages or whatever, like that could have taken a month sometimes, depending on my schedule. And for some people, that's like, that's a week for me, man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, yeah, I would like to think if I had 8 hours a day, at least like sit down consecutively and work on something, I could do that. But just having that turnover of like, okay, this is done, next project. Because before that, I did like a 6-issue, essentially graphic novel situation when I was working full time and all that. And it took years. I think I started it fall of 2013, and I didn't finish it until December of like 2017. And
yeah,
it was like, you know, it was 6 issues, but the last issue was like double size. Each issue was 24 pages. It was like, I cut a lot of teeth on it. You know, I learned a lot of stuff. I learned how to letter. I learned how to do some coloring. Because we had a colorist, but then they couldn't do the last issue. And then thankfully we had Marie Enger was available and she was able to color the first half of the issue. And then the second half of the issue, last issue, she wasn't able to, or we didn't have the money to pay her to do it.
Yeah.
But luckily I was like, okay, I see what she did. And I just like, you know, copied what she did essentially. Which she noted on, which she's like, oh, you actually made it look like how I made it look. And I'm like, well, you know, if I'm going to copy from somebody.
Yeah, you got to copy from exactly. The best.
So, but you know, I learned all about printing and all this stuff, learned how to like mentally manage a failed Kickstarter. And all these things. But the biggest lesson I learned was that was too big of a project, man. Too big. I'm proud of it. I have like a full on printed soft cover on my shelf. It sells fairly decently when I'm at shows. It's cool, but it's like, man, no, I need to work more on shorts. But now that I've worked on so many shorts and cons are kind of becoming a semi-reality again, I'm like, oh man, I really don't have anything because I don't have copies of all these anthologies that I was in.
Yeah.
So there's one guy I worked with a lot, Philip Buthorn, over the past couple years, and I think we've kind of floated the idea of taking everything we've done together and putting it together in one book, and doing like a couple new things and running a Kickstarter for that or something, just to have like a collection of all the stuff we did, something more sellable at shows and stuff like that. But yeah, I my long wind would say it's like, yeah, I get you. I feel like,
yeah,
I feel that the pool to do smaller projects. And even now, you know, I'm working on what's essentially two different miniseries at the same time and another short, and it's really fun, but it's also like, why did I do this to myself?
Yeah. I mean, the other reality is like, life is short.
Yeah.
I want to be able to work with as many people and try as many things and tell as many stories as I can in like whatever amount of years I have, like one, being on this earth, and two, like physically being able to sit down and draw.
Yeah.
You know, like,
I want to
keep moving. I want to just have all these different experiences, work with these different people, try all these different things, tell all these different stories. And like, since I am no longer in my 20s and I cannot work on like six things at once, I can work on like one monthly book and then whatever like RPG illustration cover stuff in my like evening second shift. Like, I can't double up on books.
Yeah. It's
I've done it in times where like I have really needed the money or I have really not wanted to turn out a project and needed to either overlap or work on two things at once, but it's just like, it's exhausting. I can't do it.
It's definitely diminishing returns, and not necessarily with the quality of the art, but mentally it's diminishing returns.
Yeah.
On doing something like that. And yeah, I'm definitely in that kind of space right now. Cause I was working on a book with Steve Bryant, from Athena Voltaire and The Catch and longtime buddy. And it was a book I'm really excited about. And I'm still working on it, but we're kind of like in a mini hiatus on it right now. And I started, you know, my buddy, I believe our mutual buddy, Kelly Williams, he contacted me. He's like, hey man, I was working on this book, but I'm only gonna be able to do layouts. I said, maybe you could do finishes. And overall, like the book was like, you know, I don't think this is my thing, but I want to work with Kelly. Like, I love Kelly's storytelling and like, why not? Like, and it's been a pretty bumpy road. not necessarily between me and Kelly. If anything, me and Kelly are like, we can't wait to just work on something just us together.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things where it's like, you know, I want to work with this person. Here's an opportunity to one, help them out because they were like having to step back, felt bad, to an extent about it. And the flip side was, you know, working with a friend. And I don't want to talk bad about the person. They're just new to making comics. you know, they're used to making movies. So there's a lot of learning curve stuff there that happens. And it can be very frustrating and all that. We're at the tail end of it, though. And I think everything's kind of, everyone's kind of on the same page now. But I think we're all ready to just be done with each other. though she keeps mentioning like, oh, for the next issue. And Kelly and I kind of like that monkey gif, the little puppet monkey gif with the side eye, like, let's get this one. Let's get this one done first. And then when you can get,
yeah, I know that feeling.
When you get the second one funded, let's see here. But yeah, it's, you know, and there's other people I've contacted with that I want to work with. And the problem was, like, I had so many ideas, not so many ideas, but I had a few ideas of my own that I'm like, I feel very partial to this. I want to do this. But then I have all these other friends who are so talented at writing. And I'm like, and they're, you know, one of them put forth like, hey, I'm artists. Let's do it this way. Like, who wants to work? You know, who wants to pitch me? You know, what do you got? You want me to help you work on something or whatever? And I said to him, and he seemed to be, I'm not saying his name because I don't want to put him on the spot, because it's been a while since we've addressed it, but he seemed to be pretty interested in it and all that. So hopefully, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I can have my cake and eat it too, do the story I want to do and work with someone I like. So,
yeah, that's always like the best. Like, I mean, yeah, like with Human Remains, like getting to work with Peter Milligan, it's just like, this is a writer that I was like, I was reading their work as a teenager when I was first getting into comics. So it was like a huge deal for me.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, when Adrian was like, do you want to work with Peter Milligan on something? I was like, holy shit. Yeah.
And I was going to bring that up. I was going to ask, like, were you a fan of Peter Milligan before you started? And obviously you are.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I was a huge fan of like all the Vertigo, like pretty much all the Vertigo stuff. But Shade the Changing Man was just like, game changer for me, with just the, especially like the first arc, the Chris Bacalo art on the first arc, and how like weird and psychedelic and the way he would like distort reality, was something that I looked at a lot when I was working on I Walk with Monsters. So it was like when, you know, like I kept going back and looking at that first arc when I was working on I Walk with Monsters. So when Adrian at Vault was like, hey, we have a project with Peter Milligan. Here's the pitch. Are you interested?
Definitely.
I was like, absolutely. Yes.
And with Chris Bacalo, like when he goes nuts, it's like his standard reality stuff is still kind of trippy. So it's like, when he goes off, it's off. And
all those like weird, like the giant, like Kennedy head in the like on the grassy knoll or in the desert or whatever in that like first issue.
That's super awesome. I'm trying to think like what would be like a comparable, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm working with this person moment, like similar to that. And to be honest, that would kind of be like any professional writer. I'd be like, oh my God. I don't like have a lot of super big aspirations with comics in terms of like, I want to work for Marvel or DC. Like that ship sailed a long time ago. I'm not a young man. I want to tell my stories and hopefully I can get some people to pay for them.
Yeah. I have no interest in working. Like I have no interest in doing Cape stuff. Yeah. Like I think it would be cool to do like Animal Man, you know?
Like, oh, you would kill an Animal Man for sure. That would be awesome.
I would love to do like Animal Man. Like I used to say Swamp Thing, but the Ron V Swamp Thing is just so good that I don't feel right saying that I want to do Swamp Thing, because it's like, how can I beat Ron V?
Well,
like that run, the run is amazing. But I'm happy doing like what I've been doing at Vault and like what I did at Comixology, where it's like, here's a story, live in it for a year.
Definitely. Yeah. So yeah, I can't think of like, I have superhero stories I'd like to tell, but I'm like, I don't have a Spider-Man story. I don't have an X-Men story. I have like one or two X-Men things. I'm like, oh, that'd be kind of cool, fun to do, but it has nothing to do with like current continuity. It'd just be some off the wall. Like Marvel doesn't have like a black label thing where you can just do something crazy.
and like, you know, not being continuity or whatever. Not that continuity really matters with X-Men, but
yeah.
But yeah, it's just like, I don't have those aspirations anymore. So it's like, you know, I don't know who I'd be like, oh man, I can't believe I'm working with. Maybe like Larry Hama would be like the one person I'm like,
yeah.
And that's just because, you know, Wolverine was my jam in the 90s. And, you know, that's that would be like a total, you know, full circle moment.
Yeah. I mean, I came into comics doing like mini comics and zines. And, you know, like my first exposure to comics is really like what was in the library. So it was a lot of the like Vertigo reprints that were coming out in the early 2000s, like Doom Patrol and Shade and Preacher and what else? Dead Man. You know, stuff like weird stuff like that that didn't necessarily feel like superhero stories to me, like The Invisibles, mm-hmm. you know? So the idea of being like, oh, I'm going to grow up and draw Batman, it was like, that's not a thing that I do.
Yeah.
That wasn't on my radar. It was like, I want to draw like Love and Rockets. I want to draw like whatever Becky Cloonan's doing. I want to draw like those weird, like little offbeat from the main continuity of like Sandman that like Jill Thompson was doing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's, I think when I got out of reading comics, like around 99, I want to say I was like in high school. And I'm like, you know, 99 wasn't like the greatest year for comics anyway. Everything was just kind of like, and all the good stuff that was out then, I just didn't know about or have access to. And about 10 years later, when I got back into comics, like one of my first comics I read was like We Three. And that is like one of my top three comics of all time. Cause I was like, oh.
And that's a short, concise, like self-contained story.
Exactly. And I read it and I'm like, holy shit, this is what comics can do. And that just kind of like got me back into, you know, the buying, you know, finding new comics and then eventually drawing comics again and like just back into art and all that. So, you know, when you mentioned like the stuff you got into, because a lot of that offbeat kind of stuff was the stuff that had the first collections, because that's kind of the stuff that you could put in a bookstore, you know?
Yeah. You could take it out from the library. Yeah. Like that and the like the coffee table first volume of like the Love and Rockets omnibus was like that was what I took out of the library. That's what I had access to.
Awesome. Well, not to segue too hard, but much like when you're done drawing comics and you're like, okay, I don't really feel like reading comics. I think we've covered enough comics. Let's get into the stuff we really, really want to talk about. And that's some metal.
We're gonna talk about metal.
Metal and guitars. And let's get into that nitty gritty, because I don't want to keep you on too long and I don't want to miss out on a chance to get nerdy here with this.
Get nerdy about something
else.
Yes,
exactly. So what metal has been on your list lately?
So I just made a playlist for my next like potential project. And I pulled a lot from, I have just like a 16 hour long like dump playlist of metal that's called like Satanic Panic. So I was pulling a lot of stuff from that. So it's been a lot more like 70s, 80s stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the classics like Sabbath and Judas Priest and early Iron Maiden. What else is on that list? I mean, I could open Spotify and look. you know.
Let's get into it.
Rocky Erickson.
Let's get into a super divisive topic right now. So when someone says Black Sabbath, do you picture Ozzy or do you picture Dio?
So I picture Dio as like in Dio. No. I picture like weird young hippie Ozzy. Like I didn't really like I see Dio as like he is the picture of him with the shield and the like rapier sword and the fringed boots. That's how I see Dio. And I see that as like, that is the man seeing last in life as I fight to the death.
There you go. Cause I'm new to the Dio Sabbath Appreciation Club. Cause for me, Sabbath is always Ozzy. Like that's, you know, good or bad. And I was just, you know, all respect to Dio, solo Dio, sure. Any day of the week, just the Sabbath Dio stuff. It just never really interested me. So I
think the Sabbath Dio just makes me want to go listen to act like solo Dio.
Yeah.
Or like the, like stuff like, Stargazer. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I did a deep dive into it. I had a whole like podcast episode of it when I was just going through every album. And, you know, one of the things like Tony Iommi said was like, oh, Ronnie joining the band, like, let me do more guitar wise. Cause he wasn't so limited in terms of like what he would sing and all that. And for me, that was kind of like, okay, cool. I get that. But kind of the charm was.
Yeah. I like Sabbath because it's just like, you know, I am imagining you playing these riffs, which is like a joint between your lips, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the whole appeal of Sabbath is that it's just kind of like sludgy, like the godparent of all of this, you know, like sludgy stoner metal that we have now.
It's got to be like, you know, it'll sound right if a kid who's just been playing guitar for like a week plays it, as it would someone who's been playing guitar 20 years plays it. Like,
I mean, like that riff from like into the void.
Yeah.
Is like, you could be playing guitar for like a week or like 10 years.
So yeah, I said to ask that question just because, it also kind of segues into some of our Twitter questions, mainly from noted Dio lover, Dave Jordan. he has one question, but we'll skip to a second question first, because it's more related directly to metal, and that is, tell him about your Iron Maiden shirt.
Oh, so that was the first time that I did Heroes Con was in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I was there at a splitting table with Jordan Osaka. I was kind of there with like Marie Enger and Rainey Dean, and they're friends with Kelly Williams and Dave Jordan and five other Daves that were at dinner with us.
Dapper Dave.
There's so many Daves. Yeah. And it was the first time that I had met Kelly and Dave Jordan, and they both look like serious metal dudes. And when you're a feminine presenting person wearing a metal shirt or any kind of band shirt, it either goes two ways. You either get like grilled on it or asked if you actually listen to it, or you get told that like your taste in music sucks. You know? So I was like, you know, in this like Iron Maiden shirt, and I was just like, oh man, these dudes are gonna start like grilling me on like, what's your favorite song off Killers, man? And so I'd be like, it's Rothschild, leave me alone. And then it was like they're like the nicest dudes.
Yeah.
And they were just like, oh, sweet shirt.
Yeah.
And I think maybe like a dude had like tried to grill me on it at Heroes Con. He had tried to been like, oh, you actually listen to the band? It's like, yeah, this shirt is like gray and has the armpits are gone. I've owned this shirt since I was in like high school. What do you think?
God, I just don't understand. I just don't understand it. When I, you know, just whenever I would see someone like in a shirt of a thing that I also knew, like I never ever had the compulsion to even think like, oh, why are they, that they're just posing. It's just like, oh shit, they like that too.
Yeah.
Like it's like,
it's so weird to be like, oh, I can't believe that this person also likes this thing. Like, <Yeah. laughs> let me be a dick to them. That's how we're going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. That real charming.
Yeah. The same dudes are like, oh, I don't know why I can't find a girlfriend, man.
Exactly.
Like, maybe learn how to be a decent human being first.
It's never them.
It's never them. Never their fault. Reddit told
exactly,
them so.
Exactly. So is Maiden one of like your top tier favorite metal bands or?
Yeah, I would definitely say like that trifecta, like that very basic trifecta of like, you know, like early Black Sabbath, early Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, mm-hmm. like that's sort of like the Trinity anyway. Mm-hmm. And then there's some, like, there's newer stuff that I like. Like my friend Megan, God bless her, got me very much into Ghost. I really put off getting into Ghost for a long time. And then I started running D&D for her and another one of my friends who's also a Ghost fan. I was like, oh, let me like figure out some stuff about them so I can really like make them mm-hmm. pop when I like have like, you know, Cardinal Copia pop up as a red wizard and he kills you, you know, like, cause I know that'll like make them pop, yeah, yeah. you know? and then like, I'm from Jersey. So like obligatory, I have to see Danzig.
Everyone who's picked up a guitar has learned Mother. I mean, that's just what you
do. Yeah. but I like stuff like Merciful Fate and King okay. Diamond as well.
Okay. So, you know, in my own mental classifications, like it seems like your tastes run into like the heavy metal. Like that's what I would call heavy metal.
Yes.
If someone tells me,
yeah, oh,
heavy metal, like I picture Maiden, Priest, Merciful Fate. That's what I picture because there's so many subgenres of everything that it's like, you know, symphonic deathcore. Like, you know,
yeah, I can handle like, you know, one Venom song at a time.
Yeah, that's what I love about metal too, though. There's such a variety. Like, you can just say I love metal, and you say you love those bands, and I say I love bands that you wouldn't listen to in the, you know. In the slightest, and but we're both right. We both love metal. Like it's yeah. all together. It's.
I mean, and I also like stuff like the Sword mm-hmm. and Blood Ceremony and Lucifer.
Oh, yeah.
And Ghosts that are and like Twin Temple's not metal, but you know where it's like we're kind of playing this act of being mm-hmm. devil worshippers, but sort of these like fun '60s devil worshippers.
Yeah, yeah. Like the biggest thing that. With Ghost, it, for me, is like they have so many like great melodies and songs, but some of the like the where Satan stuff is so cheesy. Like it's like
you, but it's fun.
Some of it, you know, is you know you get the tongue in cheek of it, but the other times it's like, all right, like you probably doesn't even need to mention it. No one would care. Like yeah. it definitely seems like I don't, especially lately. Like their latest album is this really like I appreciate them like. Okay, I'm going to do something different now. I'm going to incorporate a whole bunch of different other types of musical influences to what we're doing. But it's definitely like, okay, like then inserting the shtick of it. I'm just like,
yeah,
but that's just me. You know, I, again,
yeah.
you know, not everything has to be for me and I don't have to call it yeah. bad just because.
Listen, I was a My Chem fan in like the 2000s when it was really uncool. It wasn't like a TikTok mm-hmm. fun meme. Like men's opinions about what I listen to don't affect me
Good.
Anymore. I have heard all of the like worst things said to me for my taste in music when I was like a insecure little teenager.
don't get me wrong. I would have a solid ass playlist of Ghost songs. If I were to make like one epic playlist of it, like the main riff to Cerise is like one of the heaviest things. Like Pinnacle to the Pit is one of my favorite songs too. It's just one thing I do love about them. They have amazing production. Like everything sounds yeah. amazing on those albums.
My first post pandemic show back was we went to like one of the rituals. My friend Megan and I went to like one of the rituals and it was like, this rules. This is fun. This was worth leaving the house. Leaving the house for the first time in 2 years.
I definitely appreciate what they're doing, and they're trying to bring back spectacle and like be like a modern Kiss. You know, like just that's yeah. what you're doing. You mentioned another band, Blood Ceremony, and I'm glad that you mentioned them because that style of metal and all that is something I also enjoy. And there's a few other bands that I'd like to mention that you probably heard of or know, but I feel like I should mention it. There's Bloody Hammers.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're on my playlist.
And these, I don't know if you've heard of Orange Goblin.
I have not.
Okay.
I was going to also add in, who was I going to add in? Oh, first of all, I have been listening to so much Zeal and Ardor. Like, I have to say Zeal and Ardor. I'm sorry I forgot to say them before. And Year of the Goat.
Okay. I've listened to the latest Zeal and Ardor one because I've heard of them a lot. And it's never really, you know, and for the show, I try to recommend an album every episode. So I've listened to a lot of stuff and it was really good. And I was having such a hard time like talking about it. Like I just didn't. But it was just like, it's just, I couldn't like define, like, it's just good. Like there's just so many things happening here. It's like, yeah. So I'm glad you brought that up. But Orange Goblin, you say you like the sword. So imagine if the sword's main influence was Motorhead instead of Black Sabbath.
Okay.
That seems
up my alley too.
There's, I forget which album is the one that probably. It's definitely more of a, you know, definitely lots of songs about weed. I don't partake.
Listen, I like sleep, so
I don't partake myself. But I'm fine with, you know, listening to people doing their thing.
Listen, as of today, as of recording, it's now legal in New Jersey. So,
but yeah, their 2014 album "Back from the Abyss." That's a real solid album. I would suggest checking out. It's definitely more up tempo, kind of just like rocky, Motorheady type stuff, but it's definitely got that laid back, you know, stoner vibe to it. So I think it's a good accompaniment to those bands that you mentioned.
I'm looking at their album art, and it's absolutely. I'm like, yeah, yep, there we go.
They definitely know their audience, I think.
Yeah.
So awesome. So we have a few more Twitter questions, and I don't want to miss any of them because everyone has some great questions here. So we're gonna poorly segue into some of those. And first up, we have Leslie Julian asking, "What's your perfect?"
Oh, pepperoni and hot honey.
Hot honey.
It's honey with like chilies in it. So it's spicy honey. And we went to a pizza place in Asbury Park where we had a pizza with hot honey on it, and it changed my life. It is the superior pizza condiment for me now. It's perfect with the pepperoni because the pepperoni is like salty and spicy. And then you get the sweet from the honey and the like acid from the tomato. And the cheese is like perfect balance.
At first, I was like, hot honey. Oh, man. I don't know. But thinking about it and the way you described it, I'm like, with the chilies, I'm like, no. Okay. Now my interest is peaked. I don't think we have anything, you know, even though I'm close to Chicago, I don't think we have anything like that readily available. But I would definitely keep my eyes open for something with hot honey on there because I don't take to like pineapple or whatever it is on pizza, but if that's what you like, that's what you like. But I'm like sweetness mixing with the savory is like not really my thing. But if you add some spice to it, some hot to it, you know, I'm saying this, and this afternoon I had like honey chipotle barbecue wings. Not barbecue, like hot wings. So it's like I literally just had sweet and savory. So I just, don't listen to me, I'm stupid. All right. So there you go, Leslie. Thank you for asking.
All right.
Next up from John Westhoff, Part-Time Comics. What's the worst way someone has mispronounced your name?
I mean, it's always just like last name. It's always just like switching syllables around, adding new vowels, like Katrino, Katerno. Like really, like almost there. I had an art teacher in high school who could not remember my first name. Like I was in her class for like all like 3 years of high school, and she would just stand there and be like, "Megan, Alice, just Lindsay, Allison. She would just say like every girl's name in the entire school except mine. Like she could just not remember my
name.
Not
even like another S name. Just like this is running through.
No, it would just be like Allison, Kristen, Megan. And I'd be like, none of those are my name.
She like skips S's completely.
None of those are my name. Not even close.
I definitely am part of the mispronunciation club with my last name because my own mother doesn't say her last name correctly. So I just like, everyone's like, is it Cardenas? Cardenas? I'm like, whatever. Hey, you.
I mean, I think when my ancestors came over, they couldn't even really spell it right because it's not really Italian. Like, it's Italian, but it's not. Like, doesn't resemble any actual Italian words. It's kind of like, I think you might have just been guessing. I think you might have just been guessing on how it was spelled. I don't entirely know if you knew how to read.
I'm sure many, many, many surnames are the result of that situation right there. All right.
Yeah.
From Matthew Summo, he wants to know, what's your favorite cryptid and why?
I mean, I gotta say Jersey Devil. I gotta say Jersey
Devil.
Say
local.
Talking about devil worship. Great backstory. 13th child. Mom was like, I can't fucking deal with this. That popped the devil. Like, great backstory. I'd say runner up would be, you know, probably like, what was the Chicago thing that like wasn't Mothman, but it was flying around Chicago?
Oh, I'm terrible. I should know this, but.
It was like a Chicago Mothman or something.
I'm trying to remember.
What is it called? I'm going to Google it now. Chicago Mothman.
Like when I think of, for some reason, when I think of cryptids, I just think of like the part of like in the early 90s, there was a guy who dressed up like Homie the Clown and was like stalking like kids' playgrounds and stuff.
Yeah. You know, I love a good Mothman.
A good clown cryptid.
I like a good like, those little like gremlins that would pop up in like parts of Massachusetts.
I'm looking it up too. This is the Chicago Mothman. Okay.
All right. I guess there's like regional Mothman now. I hope that they, I guess it's like a Mothman franchise at this point.
Oh boy. All right. Well, there you go. And of course I have to, bring up Grant, our good old friend, Grant Stoy's question. He always has the great questions. He's like, would you still be an artist if you woke up one morning and your hands were aggressive Muppets? And of course, I asked him to please elaborate. And one would be Animal, and the other one is now a unpredictable new Muppet named Dump Truck.
So, first of all, Dump Truck sounds like it would be the name of a Muppet in like an alternate universe where like Danzig was on the Muppet Show. Like, you know, like the episode of The Muppet Show where like Alice Cooper's on and he's he's playing whatever song and there's like a bunch of cool monster Muppets that come out and like jam with him and trash the set. It would be like that. That would be the monster named Dump Truck and he would be just kind of like Sweetums, like a Sweetums sized, like person sized Muppet. But I, you know what, I'd probably still be an artist. I would probably just move into more like abstract work, abstract expressionism. Definitely work on larger format paper.
You kind of have built-in brushes, so
yeah.
You know, I think it kind of eliminates a lot of the need for additional art supplies as well. So
yeah.
Well, Grant, I hope you're happy with this answer. Oh boy, oh Grant, we love you. I'm not to speak for Sally. I love you. You're great.
I'm sure you're wonderful.
Side note, if you, in case I forget again, please check out his podcast, Into the Comics Cave. It's a hell of a good time. Full of, if you like questions like this, that podcast is for you.
If you want more questions about Muppets.
Or just things you never really wanted to think about the answer to, there you go. And our final question, and I think will probably be the last thing we can address and probably the most important thing, is from Dave Jordan, who responding to your request for someone to ask about these. And first off, I must say, I'm a little offended that both of you would assume I wouldn't ask about this.
Well, just make sure it gets covered.
If anything, this entire podcast was just a cover to ask you about this. Sally, tell us about your guitars.
Yeah. So there's my guitars and then there's my dad's guitars. My dad was a very talented musician. He was a carpenter, first of all, but he was a musician as well. And he had many guitars. I think the final count when he passed away was like 20 something guitars and mandolins. Just tucked away around the house. And we don't have a big house. It's like an 800 square foot house. It's not a big house. It's a lot of guitars for the size of the house. And so I had my guitars. So I had like a Squire, and then he had bought me a Epiphone SG, because I wanted to play his Gibson SG. He had a Gibson SG, late 60s, okay. Early 70s. Yeah. So he had vintage guitars, not because he got to be 40 or 50 and was like, I want vintage guitars from when I was a teenager. Like, these are guitars that he had when he was a teenager and in his 20s. And he just never let them go because he was kind of a hoarder.
Mm-hmm. Respect.
Yeah. So I inherited from him the electric guitars, was 70 cherry red 70s, late 60s, early 70s, Gibson SG, 64 Fender Jaguar, late 60s, non-reverse Gibson Firebird, and then like a bunch of acoustic guitars. Like, there's so many guitars. And then it was like, I had my own guitar. Like, I have a Epiphone Hummingbird. I have a Squire Jaguar, because I really like, I think up until like 2 years ago, I didn't actually think I could play guitar. I thought I was just like, I'm not built to play guitar. Like, I can't do this. This Epiphone SG is impossible to play. Like, the neck on it was just impossible. And then when my dad was in the hospital, I started kind of trying to like get as much information from him as I could about the guitars and was pulling them out and playing them. I played the Jaguar, and it was the first time I played a short scale guitar. And I was like, oh,
all the pieces fit.
Yeah, it's like that. And like, one of the other guitars I inherited from him was Gibson, a 50s Gibson parlor, not Gibson, Martin parlor guitar. So another smaller guitar. And I was like, I could play this. This is comfortable for me to play. You know, I was trying to play his like Dreadnought acoustics.
It's just a beast.
You know, he had like a Martin Dreadnought, a Guild Dreadnought, these big, very like, they're not small guitars. You know? And so I was always struggling with them to play them when he would let me play them, because he didn't let me touch the guitars. Most of the guitars when he passed away, I didn't even know he had. So now I'm like the steward to all these guitars. There was like a Gretsch Rambler, which is like a small Gretsch guitar. Some of them we've let go of because it was just like, we don't have the space. I've played them. I didn't fall in love with them. They're better served by somebody else. Someone else is going to love this. Like, there were like two harmony guitars. From the 60s.
I'm sure he'd probably be happy they're somewhere, they're getting played and used.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's like, they can go to somebody who is going to actually play them and maybe even like play them out in the world. Instead of, you know, continuing to get older in our house or in a closet.
Did you find getting more comfortable playing on the shorter scale, has that transferred over to any like more standard scale guitars?
Yeah, I definitely, yeah. So I have an Epiphone Hummingbird and a Gibson J45, and they're both like the studio ones. So they're not quite as big as a Dreadnought, but they're still closer to being a standard size mm-hmm. guitar. And yeah, I found that like being able to learn on shorter scale guitars, it's just kind of like, oh, well, now I know where things have to be. You know, I know what things are supposed yeah. to feel like. You know, you just have to stretch a little more.
Because I kind of had like the reverse of what you're experiencing, because I first started playing bass. So like I learned like on an Ibanez like 30-inch scale bass. And when I started playing guitar, for the longest time, all my guitars were like the Gibson scale length, which is what, 24.75 inches, whatever. And yeah. I have like short sausage fingers, and it's like, so everything was just like, I could play, but it was very this like, I noodle around or whatever. And then after, you know, a lot of like starting and stopping for a couple years playing, I ended up buying a Squire Telecaster, the virtuoso guitar player, John Five. He had like a Squire signature that looked really cool. So I yeah. got that, and that's 25 and a half inch scale. And I'm like, oh wait, this feels a lot more comfortable. And like, you wouldn't think like three yeah. quarters of an inch extra on the neck would make it feel like you have space to breathe and play.
Yeah. I mean, even like the curve of the yeah. back of the neck, like I find for me, it's much more comfortable for me to play things that are a little like yeah. narrower and a little more, you know, like Martins tend to have a very shallow kind of radius mm-hmm. to them. I found that with the Epiphone SG that I had, it had a very like shallow kind of radius. It was like really, I struggled yeah. with it. And so playing things that have a little bit narrower neck, a little like less shallow, a little more rounded, yeah. Feel much more comfortable for yeah. me to play.
Yeah, I definitely like, I like a thinner, I think it's a D-shape neck is what.
Yes, yeah.
My buddy, before he sold all his guitars, he liked a lot of, he had a couple of the Zakk Wylde signature guitars, and those things have like necks like baseball bats. So like yeah. I would pick up and play it, and yeah. I'm like, it just feels so off. And out of all my guitars, I have like I think maybe one or two have a slightly thicker neck, but it's not that crazy. And so, but yeah, it's just, you know, a thinner neck, slightly longer scale. Like that's just seems to be kind of like my jam with that.
The Firebird I have is just, I love it. It sounds beautiful. Mm. It's unplayable for me because it's a slab of solid mahogany. Wow. Like, it's so heavy. The neck is so thick, but it's like, it has just like this really beautiful, warm sound. And I'm always just like so sad that it's like, I can only play you sitting down.
Do you have like a combo amp, or do you like plug into your computer?
I just have like a, so I got stuff to like plug in and mess with stuff in a GarageBand, because it's cheap enough to get the like
yeah
iRig, yeah. And mess around. But yeah, for most of the time I end up playing acoustic just because it's like I don't have to go plug in an amp and pedals mm-hmm. and stuff.
Yeah.
I just have like a. It's just like a practice mm-hmm. amp. I'm blanking on what it's called. Okay. I think it's like Fishman okay. or something. I just have a practice amp because it's like not a big house. One, not a big house. Two, my boyfriend is a musician, and one day we will have to merge households.
I'll have to have him on too and grill him on all his equipment. this podcast is just.
He just bought a Mustang bass, Fender Mustang bass.
See, I can talk to him about basses. You know, it's perfect. Yeah.
He's a bass player. He's a bass player in a outlaw country band. Keep your country.
Even better. Even better. So when you play, do you like play a lot of metal? Because when you rattled off like the first few electric guitars from your dad, I just heard nothing but fuzz. Coming from those guitars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, all the pedals that I have are like either fuzz or overdrive pedals. Mm-hmm. You know, like he left me a couple like acoustic pedals.
Yeah.
You know, But yeah, anything that I've picked up has been like, you know, it's like, of course I have like a bit like the little mini, mini muff. That's a whole big muff. Just a little muff. I think like a Mojo like Overdrive. Yeah, no, when I play, I'm mostly just playing like trying to teach myself a lot of like Murder by Death songs and like a lot of stuff like Gaslight Anthem and Menzingers mm-hmm. and like pop punk, like Springsteen-y end of the spectrum pop punk. Yeah. You know, like I'm not like, oh, I'm gonna noodle okay. on a riff. I'm usually just kind of like, oh, I just want to like, you know,
yeah,
bang out a cover of a Murder by Death song. You know, it's just me and
I
my
gotta
room.
Get that mindset because whenever I pick up, it's like, oh, I have to write, I have to make some, and it's like, no, why don't you just like can riff on an let's learn a song, you know? And I used to do covers for YouTube a couple years ago, and I need to get back into doing that because that was a lot of fun and it made me a better player to do that, even if the quality of the covers was suspect. And yeah, it's just I just don't have that instant thought of like, oh, I'm sitting down, okay, let me learn this song I love that I could probably pick up pretty fast because I love this song and I know how it goes and I know enough to kind of put it all together. But it's like, no, I have to like force myself to make a thing, which is my own stupid.
Yeah. I mean, I spend all day making a thing. So all of my hobbies are like, this has to be as unmonetizable as possible. Like, I'm terrible at guitar. I'm terrible at singing. This is something I could never monetize. I'm very slow at knitting. I'm just learning cross stitch. All of my hobbies are like, I can't monetize this. Like, the only thing that's kind of monetizable is like being into playing RPGs. And that's monetizable for me because it's like, I like playing RPGs, so I'm going to do art for RPGs, and I'm going to draw art for my friend's RPGs or my partner's RPG. See, like, that's the only monetizable hobby I have. The rest, it's like, I turned my, I don't want to say hobby, but you know, I turned my like thing that I do into my job. So now I have to have other things that I do that are not my job in any way, shape, or form, and can never become my job.
You see, that's the problem I fall into with music, because I'll sit down and like, I'm like, oh, I like this, like even right now, like a buddy of mine had a Kickstarter and they wanted to put together like a little soundtrack and I had some songs. He's like, oh, can I use one of your songs to put on our little soundtrack? I'm like, sure. And then I'm like, wait, I can write a song for you. And so now it's like, I have this like idea for a song about a werewolf and I'm like, well, I got to write this now. And I'm forcibly...
and now I'm Warren Zevon. Yeah, what happened?
Exactly. More of Wolf and Man Metallica than Werewolves of London, but definitely similar subject matter. It's just like, you know, like I have the thing, and like, oh, I can make it, you know, tie in with the other thing as opposed to whatever. And you know, that's got its pluses and minuses to it. But yeah, I definitely just need to sit down and just like learn more songs. Because that's kind of fun to do. But I also, you know, I think part of my hang up with that is like, that'd be fun to do with like a band, you know, like to have go to someone's house, a drummer's house or something, and just like bang out some shitty covers and, you know, have some fun and get loud for a little bit. But
yeah, see, I started drawing comics because I didn't have enough friends to start a band. That was my first like goal, was like, I'm going to learn guitar and I'm going to start a band with my friends. And then it was like, I only have one friend. She plays bass. We don't know any drummers. I guess we're not a band.
And now, you know all these comic people, and most of them probably do play guitar or some type of instrument.
Yeah. Doesn't Liana play drums?
Yeah. And she's learning guitar too. I know her partner like made, like put together like a custom parts guitar for her that I got a grill them awesome. About get the info on that. But yeah, it's, you know, that's what something that really appeals to me too is like so many comic book creators are also musical, you know, be it singing, drums, guitar, piano, whatever, that it's like, I don't, you know, I've come across more musicians in the comic industry than I did when I was actually like gigging as a, you know, not gigging, but like playing a few shows and in an actual band itself, you know? So it's like, I don't, I my brain's just like, likes that connection so much that it's,
yeah. I mean, I think making comics is kind of adjacent to, you know, making songs as a band. I know it's not the same, but it is the same kind of like, all right, I have to be in sync with these four or five other people who are each doing their own thing. And we have to come together and like have this thing that works at the end that isn't a complete shit show. And it's like, I can't overpower the colorist. I have to accommodate the letterer. I have to work with the writer. You know, we all have to be in balance. We all have to have like whatever we have to do to all be in sync with each other. And
it's not
make it about you.
It's always, you know, it's always greater when everyone, when it's the sum of all the parts and not just one person overshadowing everybody else. You know, we had eras of comics that kind of did that and they don't last.
It's like my art has to be in service to what the writer wants, and my art has to leave room for the colorist to shine and leave space for the letterer to shine. So, you know, it's not about me. It's not about me. I have to just see where I fit in the team. I can't steamroll people.
Exactly. So, you know, before we wrap up, my final question, I guess, is what is the Sally Cantorino signature guitar? Like, you get to design a guitar from scratch. What is it?
It's definitely mahogany or rosewood. Mm-hmm. Those are my favorite sounding woods for acoustic guitars. Probably, it was parlor size in the 50s, but it's now like the same size as like the junior size guitars at Martin. Like if I had to pick like a signature guitar, so I inherited one of the guitars that I inherited from my dad is a 1957 0017 Martin mahogany. And it is like the perfect guitar. And the story with this guitar is like someone gifted it to one of my dad's friends. He was a dude who like was on disability, so his side hustle was to find guitars and fix them up. And so it's this guitar that he found in the trash that he fixed up. And then I spent $2,000 taking it out to the Martin factory and having them like reset the neck and do a bunch of like luthier work that no one else would touch. And it's like, that is the perfect guitar in my mind. It is the perfect size. It's mahogany. It's the perfect sound. It's just so loud and bright and warm at the same time. It has this like weird story to it.
Nice.
So yeah, that would be the signature guitar.
Yeah, I forgot to ask about that because I saw you posting pictures about that, like the restoration. So there you go. Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Sally, it's been an absolute blast talking to you. I don't want to keep you on too late, so you know, we'll have to do a part two.
when my next venture.
Definitely.
We'll
have to get Dave on too. We'll just have a whole forum. You know, Dave's making.
Look at Dave. Yeah, look at Kelly.
Dave's making pedals now. So you know, we'll have everybody on, and then we'll have Kelly on too, and then I can just ask you guys what your favorite Iron Maiden songs are from each album.
I already said it. It's Wrathchild. Well, it's become the Trooper in the last couple of months. Like I was listening to it in the car with my boyfriend. I was like, yeah, you know what? Steve Jordan was right. This is the best Iron Maiden song. Trooper is like the quintessential.
I have to do a deep dive on Iron Maiden because they don't grab me very well, though I respect their legacy and their ability and the whole, just them in general. But I'm like, I wish I liked them more. So I think I need to do a deep dive on them.
I think start with Killers. Like, it's sort of like, there's something about Killers that's just kind of like, this is the purest, that Number of the Beast was like, this is the purest form.
Yeah, I don't think Kelly or Dave are, you know, waiting for me to admit or come out as like, you know, I'm a Maiden head now or whatever the terminology is for Maiden fans.
I don't know.
But I'd be surprised if they weren't like, yeah, at the very least, if that happened.
Go listen all to right. The Trooper. Tell Dave Jordan he's right. At the very least,
you gotta love Steve Harris, right? There you go.
Yeah.
Well, Sally, thank you so much for coming on. If you could let everybody know now where they can find you, what you got going on, comic wise, where they can order the last or order Human Remains and anything else you got going on, now is the time to put that out.
Yeah. So, first and foremost, I have the last issue of Human Remains. Issue 8 is coming out May 11th, I believe, give or take a week, depending on the state of the world. Who knows? If you're here for like my illustration and if you're into RPGs, my partner John McGuire and his friend Gio have written a awesome Mad Max inspired RPG called Children of Uma. It's going on Kickstarter right now, I think until the end of April, so check that out, or beginning of May. I don't know, it's got like 28 days left as of recording this, so I think it's like beginning of May.
I'll make sure there's links in the show notes so you can scroll down where you're listening to this and just click a link and go right to where it is. This will be dropping on the exact date of, I'm stalling to find my calendar, the 29th.
So, May 8th?
Yeah, it'll be dropping on April 29th, this episode. So,
oh, okay.
So yeah, this will be going, you can go check it out and toss some money that way.
Yeah, and also if you want to read my past stuff, if you can figure out how to work Comixology, you can read The Final Girls on Comixology Originals. Go to your local comic shop. The trade of I Walk with Monsters is out there in the world. If you live in central New Jersey, the Geekery has I Walk with Monsters on their book club list for June or July, sometime in the summer. You got plenty of time to read it. They're a great little shop in Matawan if you're in central Jersey. And yeah, last issue of Human Remains. And then I'm kind of just hunkering down and working on whatever comes next for a couple of months. Right. I'll reemerge in the fall, like the great pumpkin, my strongest goth girl form.
Well, just in time for another awesome, Lichtober.
Yeah. Swordtember and Lichtober. See? Oh, my Swordtember drawing from last year will be finding a home some point this year. It's in progress. Another one for all of you people who play RPGs.
All right. You know, and you don't have enough Tobers to do, so I'm going to have to convince you to do Rifttober too.
You know what? That would actually probably be great. Because I need to get challenged out of my comfort zone of just playing like chords and like bar chords and power chords, you know, like,
yeah,
you should make me learn some riffs.
Well, the fun thing about doing Rifttober is like at the end of the month, I play guitar the best I ever do out of the entirety of the year. Cause I've dedicated, you know, about a half hour every day to sitting down, writing a riff and putting it out there. And, you know, so it's really stressful when I'm doing it, but it's also like, I'm so much better when I'm done. It's like, oh, practice works. So yeah, but the fun thing about Riftober, though, I didn't make it up. It's just I found that I had the idea for the hashtag or whatever, and I saw like vocal musical people doing vocal riffs, and like one or two guys had like one or two videos like Riftober. So I'm like, oh, I'll just do this. And I've done it for like the past 4 out of 5 years. And now there's like a lot more people doing it and all that. I'm not taking credit for that at all. It's just, it's not an original, an outrightly original name. It's just kind of like everyone's doing some kind of Tober. So
yeah, I should try it. I got to get out of my comfort zone. I got to try new things.
I should at the very least put forth challenges to everybody, and I should learn some Maiden riffs. That's what I should do. You know, and just put that challenge to everybody. Like, once a week, let's do a Maiden riff. You know?
I think that my, like, skill level is probably somewhere around, like, Sabbath riffs.
you bust out the fuzz. Let's go.
Yeah.
All right. Sally, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a blast.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. It was awesome. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. Please be sure to return next episode. My guest, music video director for Metallica, Monster Magnet, and comic book writer, Bill Mucci. See you then.